By canceling student loan debt, you close the racial wealth gap. By canceling student loan debt, you give women a chance to succeed in the workforce. By canceling student loan debt, you really do have a path to dignity for 43 million Americans and to be able to set a marker of like, we're going to be a country that invests in education as opposed to defunding education.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today is a longtime activist, organizer, political consultant, and campaigner who's currently pushing for the cancellation of student loan debt. I spoke with Melissa Byrne about her work in the progressive political space, which ranges from direct action against Republican Supreme Court nominations to working in Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. We had a good conversation. So, after a word from my sponsor, my interview with Melissa Byrne.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is G-R-A-P-H-I-C-A-C-Y.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
So, Melissa, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. Good morning. My name is Melissa Byrne. I am a longtime organizer that has done my work through getting people elected to office, through doing advocacy around issues, and doing creative actions. I come to this work because I come from a working class family, and I entered this work drowning in student loan debt. And that experience of really being an impacted person has led to a lot of the work I've done on the side over the last decade, which is working to make the idea of free college and canceling student loan debt a winnable issue.
Well, all important things. You said you're a working class family. Where'd you grow up and what did your folks do?
Yes, I grew up in South Jersey, and my mom was a union member who worked for the state. And so I, learned about labor unions early on and how when workers come together, you get things like health insurance and job security and pensions.
You incurred your student loan debt in college? Where did that come from?
I did. So I started out at St. Joe's University in Philadelphia, and then I transferred to Penn. And I started college in the late 90s, which is right around the time that student loan debt got deregulated. And it was just money being handed out. So I went to private colleges, but in my age cohort, people that went to public colleges also incurred a lot of debt because starting in the 80s, thanks to Reagan, we quit funding higher education. And it was all of this austerity, 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 squeeze, squeeze, squeeze. And we shifted the idea of higher education being a public good to higher education being an issue that the family has to deal with. And then if were wealthy, you would get a tax-free wealth transfer between generations. And if you weren't, you had the option of higher education in debt or don't get higher education.
So what did you study in college?
So I started out studying like philosophy and history. And by the end, I did urban studies. So basically looking at how the city and culture and people come together and really having that be the grounding of thinking about organizing that I would go into.
Were you already working or being an activist as you were in college or before?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote my first organizing plan in seventh grade. I was very concerned about the environment. So I wrote a plan to start an organization that would look at how we save the earth and how we address racism and how we address other exploitations. My theory in writing was a lot more advanced than my figuring out how to actually organize and make it real. But it was an early fomenting of how I would look at issues interconnecting each other. And then in high school, I would volunteer on campaigns and I did my first internship when I was 18 and things like that.
What was driving that, do you think?
I think like for me, I was just always aware of injustice. We had a mission to, you know, make things better. I was very, very young in 84, and it was cool seeing a woman, you know, as a vice president.
Geraldine Ferraro.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that. And then, you know, when I was 9, going and getting a yard sign for Dukakis. So actually yard signs, they kind of matter sometimes. They might not get out the vote, but they are a tangible thing that someone can do as a way to get engaged. So I just remember making my grandmother drive me to get a Dukakis yard sign, which for all of us who do campaigns know how much we eye roll about yard signs. But it was one of my entry points into this stuff as a 9-year-old.
And I think it's a little harder to study how effective they are than probably has been done yet.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, I think it's one of those things where it's become a collective, like everybody eye rolls about them, but they're a generator. It's a low level way to show your involvement and engagement and then go from there. So they're definitely important. And I remember the climate became a huge issue. So, and I was in middle school, everybody was talking about the environment. You had the big Rio conference that happened. I think it was in 90 or 91. And following that, and then the Clinton-Gore race and how much Gore centered his vice presidency around the climate. I don't think we called it climate then. I think it was fighting the ozone layer and, like, you know, reducing, reusing, and recycling, as opposed to a lot of the climate justice language that we use today.
What was that early internship you said you got at 18 or 19?
Sure. So I've wrapped up my senior year of high school interning on a governor's race. I think it was Rob Andrews, who's a congressman from Jersey, and he was running for governor. So he lost the primary to, I forget his name. He went on to become governor and then left disastrously. And then I ended up interning in his congressional office that summer before I started college. And it was really cool because I remember I got to call the VA and yell at them about getting a guy in. And I was like, oh, this is cool. And it really opened my eyes that government was more than just passing legislation. That casework is a critical part of what an elected does. And I remember being like, why don't we put this on TV every day? If we just advertise that you can just call your member of Congress and they have caseworkers to solve problems, like everybody would love government. And it's like, it was just like being 18 and being like, we don't tell like what government actually does well, and that you can just do casework, and that you can, these folks, all they do is they sit there and they're able to like solve the problems, or at least try to solve the problems of the people that reach out to them. And then the following summer, I interned for Joe Kennedy because he was working on legislation to close the School of the Americas. And I had gotten involved my first semester in college with issues around militarism and foreign policy. I went down to Georgia to the School of the Americas to protest at Fort Benning, where we were trying to shut down this military project that ended up training a lot of the future dictators and human rights abusers in Latin America. And then I found out that Joe Kennedy was working to shut it down in Congress. So I was like, freshman in college, and emailed them to be like, can I intern to work on this? And they said yes. And there I was in D.C. Doing that, which then led me to work the next semester of my spring semester, sophomore year. I was up at Boston College doing a Jesuit exchange program. That's how I met Aaron Strauss, because then I was doing another congressional internship. And we were both there together. And then I learned about how, like, you can combine data and politics in this great idea. And then, like, looking at all this stuff, like data and politics and all of this stuff ties together.
Aaron Strauss, former guest of this show and a friend of mine.
He's a good guy.
Yeah. So how did you move into the paid working world?
Sure. So, like, I got involved with Students Against Sweatshops and did organizing through that. And they actually found a way to pay us while we were in college. So I got stipended to do work organizing on different campuses, and got to go to like visit Maquiladora in Mexico and meet with workers. And it was really powerful. So I was doing organizing around the Iraq War and other issues. And then it was actually my friend Arshad Hassan, who you might know from, he was the former ED of Democracy for America and does other work in this space.
Yeah, I interviewed him as well. So,
okay, so this is great. So Arshad and I, we were you know, friends in college, and we go way back to there. We were on a radical activist camping trip. And he's like, yeah, this guy is running for president who opposed the Iraq War. And I was like, really? So that brought me into back to like more traditional politics from doing a bunch of direct action and advocacy work as I wrapped up college. So I learned about Howard Dean, helped out in his race, and then I ended up working for ACT in 2004, America's Coming Together in New Hampshire, where we were the only state in 2004 that had flipped from Bush to Kerry, but alas, Ohio broke our hearts. And after that, I went and worked for a labor union for a year, and then I went to Ohio in 06 as one of the political folks for the AFL, as a director for part of the state. I had Akron, Canton, and cut my teeth in the union halls across that part of Ohio before coming back to DC. And then I did work on anti-war for about a year and a half before going back and forth between campaigns and advocacy. And, you know, as we do in this work, you in the field 1 year, in a different place for another year.
How are you developing as an activist during this time? What were the tools of the trade that you were mastering?
Sure. I think so. A couple of things, even going back to college, I started to know, like, we found out about e-groups. And so we thought we were really cool because we were using a listserv to organize. And when we did a sit-in against sweatshops, we had cell phones. And like the New York Times wrote about our cutting edge technology of having cell phones. I think a lot of times today, anything you do, you brand as being like amazing and creative because we're in such a personal branding time. But we would just use whatever tools we had around. So we had e-groups, which became Yahoo groups. So we used listservs when we could, and we would start up new ones based on like what we were working on. And conference call, like free conference call, was like cutting edge. So part of it was like taking the tools that were available and then repurposing them for good. And being really good at that, you know, learning how to create press lists and keep those, you know, having, you know, dividing up on committee. So all of these basic skills. And as I got into the more professional work, it was, you know, what's a vote goal? It was, okay, so I know how to do some data work. So let me, you know, play around with the van, which, you know, obviously you're very familiar with the van. So I've been through, I think, almost every iteration of the van developing. And I remember back in 04, we had to export our lists, hand code them to, you know, like map them to MapPoint or Mapitude or whatever it was, and then export it into an access thing. So again, like being flexible with adapting to whatever technology we had, and then being excited once you could cut everything at once inside the tools. And then learning how to build relationships with people and to really, you know, listen to them, listen to their stories, and then work with them to move them to action. And, you know, really understanding that it's not just about getting people to do something for you and like manipulating them. What good organizing is really listening to them and being there for them. So for me, it was always, you know, after an election was more important to have volunteer meetings than before, because then people, when they see that you're there the day after the election, the week after the election, they really trust you. And then you're able to really help them get to the next step they need to be at.
When you were at this point in your career, you know, who were sort of models for you? Who did you look up to as someone you could learn from?
There weren't that many people that would go between like, let's do an arrestable action and let's do an electoral campaign. So I remember showing up to ACT and like being very critical of some traditional Democrats and getting this like, oh, we don't critique Democrats. I'm like, oh, sorry. That's what we do in West Philly. So I felt definitely like very much kind of like I was alone. And now it's really cool because like that kind of perspective of that, yes, you do work to elect Democrats, but yes, you can also critique them, is commonplace. And so I think a big part of it for me, it was I had a good cohort from my student organizing back, you know, the work I did when we were getting arrested against the Iraq War or doing sit-ins, that I had this core group of people who weren't necessarily working directly in politics, but could support me. And I would go to like with ideas and really be able to kind of, you know, help kind of create my own like weird path in this work.
How do you think about when it's appropriate for doing some kind of direct action versus waiting for the standard roads of policy and election to help make change?
I think the first part is like, one is understanding, like, are you doing a direct action to stop a bad thing? So if you look back the last 4 years, a lot of the direct actions were about stopping a bad thing and being able to get the media attention from the action to stop the bad thing. So that's why people would, you know, go to Kirstjen Nielsen's home and play the audio of the kids in cages that were crying. So that way you would get the coverage of that, and that would make her having that role untenable. Versus, say there's a new issue campaign, you don't start on day one with everybody getting arrested. And lots of times getting arrested isn't actually good, especially right now with COVID. Like, you don't want people to end up getting COVID from your actions. So I think it's really about in terms of like making sure that you're mapping out like who has the power, how are you going to influence them, and then is it going to help you win? So I think it's the same thing with a campaign. You think about like, is doing X going to help you win on an electoral campaign? So when I worked for, I haven't even mentioned working for Bernie, which has been a big part of the last 5 years of my life, and ties in with my student debt work. But, you know, on Bernie's campaign, it's, does doing this event help? Does it help us win? And it's the same with if you're trying to get climate legislation passed or student debt legislation passed. It's, is everything we're doing building us to the win? And if not, why are we doing it? And like, what can we do to adapt it to make it better?
How did you first hook up with the Sanders campaign?
I knew about Bernie, and I had worked on Social Security policy, and he was very active on protecting Social Security. So I knew about him and had friends who had worked in his office. And I heard that he was thinking about running for president. And of course, like any reasonable person, I was like, oh, that's awesome. But definitely not. I was just at first being like, okay, but there was such an inevitability around Clinton and 15 and 14 that it made any other avenues seem very, very bleak. And it's just such a narrow path. There was a great woman running for city council in Philadelphia, Helen Gim. So I was working on her race in a field in digital capacity. And it was the day of her election. And I got this email. It's part of the day of the election when you're just sitting there waiting to do your last runs. And just, you know, at that point, you've done all your work and you're just waiting for the, you know, waiting for the polls to close and waiting for the votes to get counted. And I get this email, and it was an email from the Bernie campaign asking me to tell my student debt story, to reply to the email. And it was such a good email. And like, I knew the people who wrote the email. Like, I know everybody behind the scenes, but it was that good. And then I'm like, okay, I have to do this, because it really clicked in my head that there wasn't somebody that's going to write like a $10 million check to fund campaign around free college and canceling student loan debt. The power structures didn't work that way, especially like 5 years ago. People were like very much in that, oh, that's cute, you want to cancel student loan debt, or that's cute, you want free college. It wasn't taken seriously, especially at the donor level. And I realized in that moment that the number one path to making this issue popular was to get Bernie to do well. And so that day was the day I decided I was going to work for Bernie. It took a bit of time, a couple months, and then I ended up as the digital director in New Hampshire. And I also knew that I didn't need to be the one writing the policy. I just needed to make sure he did well, and that him doing well and then being in a role to amplify this issue would be how we make it popular. And back then in 15, Bernie wasn't talking about canceling student loan debt. And so I also knew that it wasn't about having him be perfectly aligned with me on like where this policy needed to go. But it was, he wants free college for public, that's great. And then we can push on the other side. And then fast forward to 2019.
Well, don't fast forward so quick, quite so quickly. Tell me a little bit about being digital director in New Hampshire in 2016. What was that like? What did you do? It must have been pretty exciting, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's an insurgent campaign is so different than a front runner campaign.
Yeah. And so I got both experiences on each race. So as the insurgent, I got New Hampshire in the fall, and there's nothing like fall in New Hampshire. There's the leaves are amazing. So being up there, one, because I had a field background, I really understood what the field department wanted to do. And so I was really able to ensure that what we were doing digitally in the state was complementary to what the field department was going to do. And then I've had a bunch of communications experience with a lot of my client work. So I understood what communications needed to do. So I was really lucky to be in a position where I really understood the different departments and could work with the other teams to be like, how do we make sure this all works together? And then how do we be aggressive on the issues? And so we were able to, you know, run Facebook ads on the issues and see how people responded, collect their stories, like do emails based on people's stories and really centering it on storytelling. And that part was great. And then, you know, making sure that we're using digital to get out the vote and, you know, hit our vote goals. And we won everywhere in New Hampshire in 16. And that was a really great feeling to be able to win so strongly that it won and able to raise a lot of money to keep the campaign going and to really show that in a state that's considered a swing state, which New Hampshire keeps being categorized as a swing state, that you can, you know, you can win a race when you want to close private prisons, when you want to make college free, when you want to have Medicare for all. and that you don't need to run away from the issues that actually improve everybody's lives.
And I assume that your attachment to him as a candidate got even stronger through that process.
Yes. I mean, he's great. And being at all the events to be able to cover them, to take pictures and tell the story and see everybody's attachment to him and like how much he would listen. One of my first events with him when I was on staff, we had a up in Claremont, New Hampshire, there was a Veterans Day parade. And so he went and walked in it. And then there were some vendors there. And I was like, oh, do you want to get a picture? And he's like, oh, no, he always comes to our VA. We live over in Vermont. We see him all the time. And just, I'm like, okay, that's awesome. And seeing that connection, seeing people from the whole age spectrum to younger people don't put up with bullshit. So they see, right, they see that he doesn't have any. And so they are into him and fight for him, to the older folks, to people on Social Security benefits who know that he's going to fight for them. And so that part was really amazing. And seeing that you don't have to run politics based on poll testing and like, you know, being timid, and that you can be brave and you can be strong and you can get really far. And we did really great. I mean, I went to South Carolina after New Hampshire in 16. So that was a bit of a different experience, but the organizers that came out of there were amazing and are now doing great work. So we both were able to push forward on the issues and then have a great new class of organizers come up from the work.
How did you navigate that fall when there'd been such a split in the party and people were pretty cranky across the Sanders-Clinton camps, but we needed to win?
I think people are still cranky. I think for the general, I mean, it was hard because they're minimal people from the Bernie campaign were hired in 16 over to Clinton or to coordinate it. So I ended up going to Move On. And so Move On ended up hiring a bunch of us. So I was the state director for Pennsylvania and New Hampshire. And I saw, like, I think in the week leading up to the election that, oh, this is going to be bad. And thankfully, a poll came out showing that Clinton was behind in New Hampshire. So that woke up the whole Boston suburbs, and enough volunteers came that we were able to win by about 1,000 votes and also get Maggie Hassan elected. And unfortunately, in Pennsylvania, it was a mess. And we all know what happened. And I think that, so then I saw that we were going to have open DNC elections. And I saw that other people my age were going to run, but nobody from the left was running. So I ran for DNC vice chair, which I had no shot of winning, but it inserted me into the conversations. And so I was able to get enough petition signatures. And it's really strange asking for yourself as opposed to others.
I bet. Who else was running? Well, who was the favorite and who won?
I mean, so there were two spots for vice chair. And so Grace Meng, who had just been appointed, because she got appointed as a vice chair when there was when Debbie Wasserman Schultz, she replaced Tulsi because Tulsi quit because she endorsed Bernie. That's a whole, we don't need to talk about that. And so Congresswoman Grace Meng was appointed to vice chair, and then she ran for a full term. And I love Grace. I was really excited when she won. And then Michael Blake won. Like, he was running, and then like, I think a few other folks were running. And then there was like, I think seven of us for vice chair for two spots. And so we had these forums. I went to like Dallas and Phoenix and Detroit and Baltimore for these forums. And then the elections were in Atlanta. So I got to talk in all of these areas and lay out, this is like in January and February of 16, that one, the Democratic Party should be the center of fighting Trump and resisting Trump. So I was naming that and laying it out. And then I was also naming and laying out, like, as someone who worked in digital on Bernie, that it wasn't our digital that was special or unique. It was Bernie's message. And we happened to have the best digital program to be able to capture all of the energy and support for Bernie's message. And I was like basically on repeat being like, this is really bad that you don't understand that it's about the message. Like, it's not about just building tools. You have to have something that people want to fight for and people to believe in. And that's what gets our people involved. And that's how you bring our people into the Democratic Party.
So how did it feel being a candidate rather than supporting a candidate?
I mean, it was weird. I also just, I felt like I was just kind of like making it up as I went and that I didn't have a right to be there. So a lot of just that. And then, but all the people that I met during that process were amazing. I got to meet Nikema Williams and get to know her, and she's now going to be in Congress. I was supporting Keith for chair, but I got to know Tom Perez's team. So then when Tom had his transition team, he realized he needed to have some folks from the left on his transition team, I got a call. So then I got to be on the DNC transition team. Then I was at the table And so I'd be like, okay, we got to have paid internships. We need to talk about the left. We need to understand that we need to win all these races. So then we can fight about policy. And really keeping arguing that you can't divorce policy from politics. And that we, so often the Democratic Party, we have policy people in one area and then operatives in another. And really going forward, the policy is what's going to drive our politics and how we're going to build and expand. So that got me. And then I worked at the DNC with Keith Ellison for a little bit and got to really know folks there. And so it really brought me in, but also in a way that I'm still me. So I would talk about why Cuomo shouldn't run for re-election. So whereas a lot of folks do this work, I'm like, if I'm going to do this, I still have to be me. So, and that's been really exciting.
I mean, speaking of you on your, I don't know, it's LinkedIn, I guess. You title yourself Brawler for Social Justice. Maybe it's Facebook. What do you mean by that?
Oh, so that was when I ran for DNC vice chair, a couple of the Philadelphia outlets wrote about me. And one of them, he's with the Daily News, he called me the Brawler for Social Justice. It's kind of stuck. So I was like, oh, what do I put on this? And then Facebook had this new tab and I'm like, what do I put here? And I was like, oh, let me use that quote. That works. It's really because like I'm generally like a lot of times people in, as you know, you mean you work in this space, is a lot of people tend to be really timid and they don't want to offend people and they're afraid to, really stake out the hard positions or be first on an issue or if, say something that might get somebody with power mad at them. And I tend to be like, I don't really care. I'm just going to be authentic. And, you know.
When did that arise within you? For most people, it is super hard to even like walk into their boss's office or ask for a raise or ask someone for a dollar for a cause or much less, you know, organize a sit-in at a senator's office. Where did that willingness to just go into it come from?
I think I just always have been that kind of just like dive right in. And I think I'm lucky in that I think a lot of people in politics, they really need to be liked. Like I like to be liked. I mean, doesn't everybody, but I am okay if I'm not. And I just have a clear understanding of really understanding what it takes to make about change. I had a class in college, I think it was my first semester, sophomore year, on Latin America and social justice and social policy. And in studying everything that happened in Latin America in the 80s and like the 70s and like really seeing what people went through when the stakes were, people really were being killed by death squads and looking at what was effective. And it was when you had the intersection of the inside game and the outside game. And when you're situated at the intersection of the inside and the outside, you make everybody mad at you because you're not fully a part of either side, but you're at the space where you can like navigate between the worlds. And so I saw that early on, I think. So being like 19, I saw that as like, that's where you make the most change and that's how you get the wins and have just, you know, lived in that space for better or for worse.
That sounds stressful to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the easiest. But it's also like you get cool wins and you get to like actually move policy and you get to stop bad things. So that part's exciting.
Who doesn't like you then?
I don't think Jason Furman likes me today.
He's working on the other side of the student loan issue, maybe?
It's funny. His salary at the Kennedy School is funded through student loan debt, which is like hilarious. I don't think he has that self-awareness. And he's at the Peterson Institute. Like you have some of the folks that want to concern troll that if we cancel student loan debt, it's not the biggest driver of the economy, making things better.
It's people worried about the large national debt and student loans are up in the trillion, right?
Yeah, it's 1.7 trillion. I think people are going to start talking about that because, you know, when Republicans are in power, no one cares about deficits. But then the concern trolls show up about Democrats and deficit because, you know, that's just the way that it goes. But it's great because we went through all of this with Obama and all of us that were younger with less access to power are now older with more experience. So we're like, can be like, oh, we know their playbook. They're going to say this about the debt. They're going to say this about the deficit. They're going to, you know, have Maya McGinnis say this. They're going to have Peterson Institute people say that. So we know their playbook, which once
they're pretty predictable.
Yeah, they're not creative. And the problems are so much bigger. So it's like there's 43 million people with student loan debt versus what, a handful of like, you know, annoying economists. So I like our odds. It's like we're good. And it's also, we're lucky because the Democrats were able to create the conditions that were able to have Trump pause all federal student loan payments since March. Now it's the situation of if you make somebody pay their loans, it's now on the Democrats are making them pay their loans. Who wants to be the one that gets an attack ad to be like, in the middle of COVID, Democrats brought back student loan payments? So we're in a good place right now for that. So I think that just generally, I think a lot of people, there's also in politics, there's like, you're supposed to wait your turn and you're supposed to have people open the door for you or like people to appoint you and to say you're now the next person. And I've just kind of have done what I thought was right at a given time. And I haven't always been, I mean, I've learned a lot over the years. So I wouldn't be like maybe as aggressive or flippant as I might have been in the past. But it also then gives me the, when I see people that are newer to doing this work and are being a little more flippant, it gives me the grace to be like, okay, you're going to do good work. I know where you're coming from. And understand that everybody in this space is that we're all at different places in our own journey, and how we respect and understand people who are at different spots. And I, you know, really give people the benefit of the doubt and to assume the best intentions. Then we're able to work together and to really appreciate what skills and gifts everybody brings to this like tapestry of change.
Yeah, I'm always sort of noting the need for the people who really push boundaries, and also the sort of risk in that of backlash. I think it's a pretty complicated calculus and not one that you can always know in advance how things will go when you're talking about really pushing change from the left. Like, how do you get that right? How do you think about that?
I think it's hard. I mean, I definitely 100% support the people who've been pushing to fund the police. We've been able to make incredible progress on the American public looking at that issue and really understanding that all of the work, all the money that's gone into defunding schools, defunding hospitals, defunding health, and that has been shifted into policing communities and putting people in jail and over-ticketing people and funding cities based on tickets as opposed to funding them on equity. A lot of people's eyes have been opened. I think a lot of people who do this work don't have experience on the front lines and don't have experience working with impacted people. So then they start panicking. And then sometimes you have a former CIA operative who then freaks out on a caucus call and starts a whole kerfuffle because she just doesn't understand. She doesn't come from a movement space.
That's an important point, because a lot of time I think an understanding develops, say, in the movement space or on campuses, and change has happened and people are thinking about things freshly and new and kind of agreeing with each other, but the general populace hasn't come along to that. And it can cost you. And a slogan like defund the police, she may be right that that was used effectively against Democrats in this election. Was it worth that price? I don't know that anyone can say yay or nay on that.
I think folks who come from a more traditional background don't understand that like the left doesn't operate in a top-down manner. And
definitely. So
trying to argue like whether or not somebody should use a phrase doesn't get you anywhere, because, you know, organizers are going to do what they think is right. And that what you can do is make sure that you're focused on communicating your own message effectively. And I think that's something like we don't always do well. For example, in Sue Annenberger's district, she actually ended up with more votes and a higher margin. So like there wasn't anything negative on her. And then when you look at a bunch of the districts we lost, those were ones that we were able to win because Republican turnout was just lower in 18.
Yeah, those were all Trump districts that were very challenging to hold.
I don't think any of them that were a Biden carry had the Republicans win. I mean, there's been some issues with ticket splitting. And I think we have to, that goes back to how do we as Democrats communicate our message? But I don't think we communicate a message and build power by, you know, reflexively attacking the left, which I think is, it's much easier to do. One, the left has less money to be able to fight back on attacks. And it just makes it like easy to blame the left as opposed to understanding like what people are going through, that a lot of times it's they're not the ones that are seeing the true pain that's happening in communities and like what it means to see that pain and look at that pain and not be able to fix it. And so we have, you know, there's a lot that needs to get done. And I think that a lot of it's going to have to come from the different factions of this big tent being able to, you know, trust each other. I mean, look at like Alyssa Slotkin. She didn't spend her race, you know, attacking the left. She focused on looking at the data, anticipating that the polls were wrong, and then adjusting her vote goal. And she hit her vote goal and won. If the other members would have done that, as opposed to start panicking, I think we'd be in better places. And I think this gets to like, we let the, a lot of times Democrats just let the Republicans, you know, run away with their attacks and they panic, as opposed to just eye rolling and being like, oh, Republicans are going to Republican. You're talking about socialism. Well, here's what we mean. We mean healthcare. We mean this. We're going to help your families. And like, we don't push that message. Instead, we start, I think the South Florida Democrats spent like, you know, 6 months saying that they're not socialists and attacking Karen Bass and attacking Bernie Sanders instead of defining who they were and why they should get reelected.
That makes some sense. You had alluded to client work. What kind of clients have you had over the years?
Yeah, I've done a lot of great work with, you know, doing the smaller actions. Like, I also don't think that you always need a million people in the streets. Sometimes 20 to 30 people effectively can get a lot done. So I've been really lucky to work with Ultraviolet for over the years. So starting with them, I think in 2012.
Well, tell me about Ultraviolet. I don't know them well.
So they're a women's organization that started, I think, in 2011, and they did some of their first actions in 2012. And so they look at putting a price tag on sexism and gender issues. It works to make it so folks make better decisions and that you don't have corporations and government behaving badly. So for that, it's a lot of, you know, doing fancy petition deliveries around the country, getting the earned media that comes from bringing together folks in the streets to, you know, do a presser and do an action. So I did some work for Some of Us and a few other organizations. So I would do that and then go on a campaign and then come back from a campaign. And so I've done that for, I think, since 2012. And then being able to really develop the public communications and, you know, being super creative with actions, which led to a lot of the work that I did during the Trump years.
And you picked up again with Bernie in California in 2020, right?
I did. I said I was one of the directors out there. I was the only one in California that had worked on the campaign before. So it was really great to be out there as the alum, working as the grassroots director, and, you know, being able to take my, you know, field digital and other political work and roll it all into one. We work with a great team and also get to learn a new state. I was born in California and lived there till I was almost five. So it's my first time being able to go back and live, and being there as an adult for a year was really a gift. So it wasn't what I thought I would end up doing on the campaign, but it ended up being perfect. And we were able to win. It was Super Tuesday state. So the Sunday of Super Tuesday, we had the Chuck D Fight the Power concert with Bernie. And as we were setting up for that, Pete endorsed Biden, Klobuchar endorsed Biden. And it was just this, like, you're seeing this like nightmare happen. But thanks to early vote, we had started getting our vote out on February 3rd. So we had been pocketing our votes the whole month. So even though there was that collapse that was happening, we were still able to win California by 8 points. And then my team from California, for the most part, went to New York. And so we flew to New York on March 9th and landed in New York right as the pandemic was hitting peak level. 4 days later, we became a work-from-home campaign. I was literally at the last in-person Bernie event. We were running it, and we got the call that we're work-from-home. So we had to end that event. And that event that day, we were like, the health information was changing hourly. So it got to the point where we had to make a call to be like, tell the organizers, don't do confirmation calls. We need to keep this at under 50 people. We're following whatever that updated health rules were. And then we became work from home. For me, the great part of working for Bernie again was everybody would call us for advocacy. So they'd be like, this bad thing is happening. Can Bernie solve it? And really seeing that connect of everybody wanting Bernie's voice to speak out on an issue, because if Bernie spoke about it, people would listen. So we were able to, you know, weigh in on a bill to ban private prisons in California. And we were able to weigh in on other, you know, issues around climate change and fires and that were happening in California, and to really use that megaphone. So Bernie got to go up to Paradise, California, and do a walkthrough and see what had happened there the year before with that horrible fire. And we got to do, you know, town halls and immigration issues where we would have translation equipment and really bring into like there, how can we make campaign events more and more accessible? You know, we did an event on the border in San Ysidro, and that was really powerful and having those stories amplified. And we did an event with college students on student debt and free college and getting them at the table with the senator to talk about it. All of that adds up together. So it was a really phenomenal experience. There was such great organizing in California that the people that were involved stayed involved. And if there was a city council candidate, Nithya Raman, she was an outsider, ran against an incumbent, David Ruhr, made it to the runoff, which California for most races, it's a top two. So it's not a partisan primary. She had come to an event we did on public housing with the senator on a homes guarantee that was incredibly powerful. AOC stopped by Cornell West. It was this amazing, amazing event. She made it to the runoff. Bernie ended up endorsing her during the runoff, and she ousted the councilman this fall. And so one thing that gives me a lot of hope is seeing that how many seeds that were planted from this campaign and how much the work from this campaign was able to get lots of other people to run for office and to win elections. And knowing that this was a start of something huge. Actually, not really a start, it's a continuation. Because I think that like no one owns organizing. And that we all go, whenever you enter, you're building off a ton of work that's been done by others over the years.
What was the high and the low for you in 2020?
The high was definitely, you know, the results from Iowa are still a little fuzzy. I don't think we'll ever know who actually won the Iowa caucus. We don't talk about Iowa. But, you know, being able to win New Hampshire again, even though it was a bit tighter, but it's a different dynamic. You know, the huge win in Nevada. So that was all highs. And it was really feeling like, oh my gosh, we might actually do that. But also understand the responsibility of that. Because like, oh wow, if you're actually going to become president and your team is, it's a huge responsibility. And like really sitting with that
responsibility. Or if you're going to go up against Trump and we have to win that. It's a huge responsibility.
I wasn't worried about it. I knew that we would defeat Trump. I knew that we had the message to defeat Trump, so I wasn't as worried about that. I knew it was going to be exhausting and grueling and a lot of work, but I was working for Bernie because I was confident that Bernie would be able to beat Trump. And that's what, you know, drove my decision making every day. And then seeing the results from Maine and Massachusetts and Minnesota and like, you know, being able to see that, oh, a shift had happened and understanding. Like that was really bad because we won California, but I also knew that because of the way the other states had went, it made winning the whole nomination that much harder. So it was really just sitting with that and then having, you know, the pandemic happen in the middle of all of that. And, you know, when we were in New York, it was, okay, what's the most good that we can do during this process? So it was, you know, doing Zoom town halls on housing and rent relief and canceling rent. It was doing Zoom town halls on healthcare and getting people involved and what can we do to keep pushing on the issues. I was lucky to be on the New York team for that part of it because all of us, we worked until the buzzer went off. We were literally planning new events when we all had to get on a conference call. And we kind of knew that as soon as we got like everybody all staff call at 11 in the morning, I'm like, oh, I think I know what this all staff call is going to be.
Ouch.
Yeah. And, you know, by that point, they had figured out that they were going to pay our health insurance through the end of October. So the first campaign to pay everybody's COBRA for 6 months, and which should be standard practice for campaigns, is making sure that your workers have health insurance afterwards. So that part, like, no. And then at that point, they had also then Congress had passed the CARES 2. I forget the number. I forget what round it was that would have the expanded unemployment benefits and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think that part, I mean, it was really hard and like we didn't get to say goodbye to each other. I ended up staying in New York for a few months at a friend's apartment. It made sense for me just to stay there because I was afraid that I had been exposed and didn't want to possibly carry this thing to another place. So I just kind of hunkered down there. And luckily there was a couple of other Bernie people. So I met up with Daniela and we got lunch that day at Washington Square Park, 8 feet apart. So it was good to see another human from the campaign, but like we weren't together in person to say goodbye to each other and to like process what we had accomplished and what we hadn't. And that part was really hard. we did pull together, since it was the same staff for California and New York, we pulled together a California and New York volunteer call. And we got, you know, I think we had like 2,000 people on the Zoom. And we were able, and AOC stopped by the Zoom to show appreciation and to give marching orders for keeping the fight. And we had this singer, Leah Rose, join, and she sang a song that she had written inspired by Bernie called If Not Now, When? So we created this experience and event for our volunteers and put together photos from everything we had done and had that and held that space. And that was like a really great way to understand that it's not so much the campaign ending, but us recommitting to keep fighting and to move forward from there.
What did you do in the fall as the general election was going on, and what's your views on how that all transpired?
I started doing right away. There's the need for direct actions, and I needed something to do. So I was able to work on a few direct actions starting in April, which involved dropping off body bags at Trump Hotel to create images to really show what Trump's COVID failure was doing. And, you know, bringing coffins to Lafayette Square in, I think that was May. It's pandemic, so months are kind of blurry. So I was back to doing a bunch of like really cool creative actions. And then I worked on some stuff with the DNC War Room. And so that was really great to be back with the DNC family. And then RBG died. And so I worked with Demand Justice on trying to stop Amy Coney Barrett. And that was, you know, definitely a David versus Goliath fight. And, you know, it was, you know, almost impossible. We tried really hard. And unfortunately, you know, Lindsey Graham knew that by getting ACB installed, he would be able to, you know, be owed huge favors by the evangelical community. So that unfortunately made it a lot harder for Jamie Harrison. But we tried really hard to stop Amy Coney Barrett.
Yeah, kind of a rough ending to the – I think that death was bad on so many levels politically and judicially. Ugh.
Yeah, it was bad. And I think the timing was terrible and the Republicans are terrible. And so it was just a mess of terribleness all over.
And now we have a president who's been defeated who says he hasn't been.
I am one that tends to really use a lot of hyperbole. And I think that hyperbole is an amazing, amazing tool for organizing, and being very animated and being very aggressive is very important for organizing. And I'm the one right now who I'm like, basically, like, I'm just not worried about Trump at this point. Well, I'm not worried about him in the sense of transfer of power. I think that we need to worry about Republicanism and Trumpism going forward, and just how good they are at organizing and using tools, and how they're experts at using hate to build power. And we have to think about that every day. But when it comes to his freakouts every day on Twitter, I think a big part of what he's doing is he knows that when he says things like he won, the left and the center left and the moderates in unison freak out. And he's a reality TV guy at the end of the day. So he is all about conflict. And I think it's really important for us to use the time now to have a plan to really defeat Trumpism over the next 3 to 4 years and longer, and really understand that Republicanism is Trumpism, and like what the evolution, if you were in a SimCity simulation and you started with Reagan, the natural progression is to Trump. And that's one thing we didn't do well in the general, is that I think a lot of the messaging was that Trump is bad, but other people are good. I think the Republican voters against Trump was really harmful for us. And that gave the other Republicans an out and let people think that it was okay to split tickets without understanding that, no, Hawley is really bad. A lot of what's happening down ballot with Republicans is really bad, and they are no different than Trump. So I'm confident that we will have a transfer of power. I know personally the Secret Service is very good at escorting people out of places they're not supposed to be, and that we just have to just endure the next 60 days of his temper tantrums. And then from there, we think about long-term building.
I mean, it's interesting. The Biden team has not really participated in the freakouts from what I've seen.
No, I mean, I think it's so fun because I'm very synced up with how they're thinking. And I've been out early on the calm, like the whole, like, don't freak out, just ignore him and, you know, be aware, but that.
Don't give this troll the energy.
Yeah. This is just who he is. Like, you have to imagine, like, if you were in a writer's room, what would.
No one could write this plot.
No, but like, this is like, what would a reality TV show be doing right now? And this is exactly what they would be doing for the conflict. And that doesn't mean the grassroots shouldn't be prepared for a worst case scenario. Like, absolutely. But I have faith in our grassroots. I have faith in our hard left that if there was a legitimate problem, they would all spring to action. So that means everybody else just needs to mute him on Twitter and, you know, express your concerns in your group chat as opposed to, you know, amplifying his weirdness.
So tell me about your aspirations in the student loan area and what you're up to.
We have the ability to get the federal loans canceled. So you can actually use an executive order to wipe them all out. And that would take care of a very significant portion of the debt and be able to then buoy the ability to get a bill passed to make public colleges and universities free and to get rid of the private student loan debt. And yes, would it be better to do everything at once? But that's not reasonable right now. So what we can do is to improve lives for 43 million Americans with one signature and then take the goodwill from that and use that as power to be able to work for more change.
I mean, know that that there's all these transition working groups. Are you aware of what's going on in that area in Biden world? Are they preparing to do that or is that unlikely?
I mean, I don't know what they're preparing to do, but I do know that Schumer is supportive of executive action to get rid of student loan debt. We were able to get in the Democratic platform to look at administrative action to cancel student loan debt. Well, they use the word forgive. So the advocates use cancel. A lot of the electeds and Biden use forgive. It means the same thing. Cancellation is a better phrase because we didn't do anything wrong. Forgive kind of implies that the people with debt did something wrong and that they need somebody to forgive them. So there's a bit of a linguistical nuance with it. But otherwise, you know, we're on the same path. So I'm not going to argue about language. So we just use the words that come from our spaces and just go from there as opposed to getting in a fight about words.
Do you still have your own debt out there?
I do. I still have mine. So that would be personally great and great for, you know, everybody from the people on Social Security benefits, getting their benefits garnished, to the 18-year-old who is hunched over their bed doing Zoom university right now. Like, people are going into debt right now to sit on Zooms in a corner of their house where they can get some quiet.
You can predict the arguments that will be made on the other side. What do you think are the arguments that are most concerning that go against cancellation?
You have the people who say, well, what about the people who already had their loans canceled? So you have those. And then a lot of people right now are replying on Twitter, well, we shouldn't have a COVID vaccine because what about everybody else who already had COVID? They're going to be mad. So that gets, you know, brushed away really quick. You have the people who say, well, we don't want to give anything to rich people. And it's like, no, no, no. People with debt are not rich. And so, cool. What about the doctor who's making X amount of money right now? It's like, well, they have the debt because they weren't rich when they started out medical school. And like, what the debt is doing is it's taking away the economic impact of the work they're doing as a doctor. So you have someone who's a COVID provider, but has, you know, 300 grand in medical school debt and doesn't have the same. And then what, you know, if you add an interest, it's like probably like paying back $500,000 over the course of their career. Like, why should someone have that much of a burden on them just because they weren't born wealthy? We shouldn't be punishing people for being born poor or working class. And that's what it really gets to, is that we have set up higher education to be an intergenerational wealth transfer. So if you're wealthy, you write the check and your kids get to go to college and grad school and start their lives without any debt from education. And if you're not that, then they have that choice to be like, well, we go into debt or we don't get access to education. And these aren't fair choices. And it doesn't have to be this way. And this is also why for free college, like, I don't think it should be means tested. I think public education is a public good. And I would rather the kids of billionaires go to public college and get their school for free and to be able to have a peer group from a huge diverse background than everybody cloistered up with their class groups as they progress in life.
What's Project Springboard?
So that's when I first tried to do student loan debt work. I had tried to start up a project and was starting to do it. But then this guy, Bernie Sanders, decided to run for president. And that's when I realized that I would never be able to raise the amount of money it would take to make this a huge thing. And that working on the campaign would do way more to accelerate the issue than me having my own branded project.
So what's your plan for the next year? How do you plan to employ your talents, or what are you looking for?
I'm still figuring out that. I think for right now, I want to, you know, really think of it as like we have a sprint for 60 some odd days until Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are sworn in. And I think that one of the first things they can do is to do an executive order to cancel federal student loan debt. And if they were to kick off their administration by canceling all federal student loan debt, it would hit every community in America. And everybody, you know, 1 in 10 Americans have student loan debt. So that means basically everybody in America knows somebody with student loan debt. Everybody has people in their family with student loan debt. And if you take away that federal student loan debt in the middle of a pandemic, you're going to see people's lives improve. And that's like the first down payment on building back better.
What do you think the chances are? I mean, I can imagine that they are looking at many different trillions that they need to put into everything from pandemic ravaged state governments and local governments and all these businesses that are in trouble and people that are in trouble. How do they make that call?
Well, one, the money's already spent, so it doesn't add anything. It's just, you know, it's like made up numbers on a balance sheet. So
our national debt would increase by that amount, right?
No, because it's already there. So it doesn't add anything. Stephanie Kelton, you should get Stephanie Kelton on your show to talk about the nitty-gritty of the economics behind a lot of this new way of looking at economic policy, because I'm not an economist. I am an organizer.
Who is Stephanie Kelton?
She is a professor, and I believe she's at SUNY Stony Brook right now, but she is part of the people who work on modern monetary theory, which is the idea that you don't need to worry about deficits. As long as you're spending and investing in the public, then people have more money to spend, and then that keeps the economy going. And so a part of the stimulus that comes from the canceling all the student loan debt is then people will take that $500 to $1,000 to $2,000 a month that they're paying on their debt, and then they're able to buy a home. So then that stimulates the economy. They're able to start a business, or you can, you know, go and buy the things that you need to buy or pay down other debt. So that's like where, by freeing up all of this in people's personal finances, you're then able to see this huge wave across the country for years from everybody who can now spend directly into their communities.
When we paid for people's education through the GI Bill, there were long-lasting positive effects from that, even from that subset of the population.
Yep. And then this way we can do it. You have the ability to, you know, have the dignity of being able to like choose your own life without having, you know, Navient or Sallie Mae or whatever acronym of companies control it for you. We were doing it. We were doing free college until Reagan and his Ayn Rand acolytes started, you know, defunding schools. There was no freak out and people were defunding schools. The selfish people were very good at marketing themselves. And so we just have to counter them.
What about all these like not very good private colleges and online colleges that have loans to people that are selling things that aren't really that valuable? How do you deal with that aspect of things? Obviously not covered by forgiving federal stuff.
So one of the challenges is that a lot of them do have federal loans. And so they basically take all this money out. And so I think like one, there's just no need for for-profit colleges in the United States, and we should quit accrediting them. So they should, if they are not accredited, then they don't have access to the federal student loan money for their students or the private student loan money. So I think that like there's just no reason to have any for-profit university accredited. we can have a lot of the stuff that is done through technology training or, you know, medical training in terms of like medical record coding, becoming a phlebotomist and other of those kinds of certifications can all be done through community colleges, which should then all be free. And so with the difference is that the for-profit entities have a ton of advertising budget. And I'm sure that over the years, you've seen a ton of advertising for like ITT Technical or Phoenix University because they have ad budgets. I think that if we were able to have ad budgets for community colleges and have ad budgets for the local four-year public college, then you'd be able to get people that needed these certificates and get these programs. So then they're getting their career readiness to be able to start working without having the debt. So we don't need the for-profit higher education system. We should just get rid of that.
I'm assuming that's quite a lobby. Is that right?
Yep. But thankfully, they're just so bad at what they do that they have done such bad work at educating students and just becoming like a predatory money trap, that there is a lot of power to get that done. What needs to go hand in hand, ideally within the first year or two after the free, after canceling the federal student loan debt, is to make public colleges and universities tuition free for everybody. You know, make it so for-profit colleges don't have access to loan money. And then for students who do need to have some loans taken out to cover housing or other costs, drop that federal loan interest rates down to 0.01%. So you're literally just covering the cost of servicing. So then you have that opportunity for people that need to have their housing covered or have that, can get that, you know, paid back in a reasonable timeline.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see how far this administration's able to go on this. I know that they've made some commitments. Melissa, is there a question I failed to ask that I should have?
One thing in terms of like who does the student loan debt cancellation benefit? I think it's really important to understand that. It's a lot of times when people think student loan cancellation, you think of like someone who went to Harvard Law School and not wanting to pay back their $200,000 that they took out for their Harvard Law degree while they're, you know, working away as an associate for some white shoe law firm. But really the face of student loan debt, it's Black women, it's Latinas, it's first generation college students who have their loans from their undergrad. It's someone who is working public interest at a law firm, you know, making $40,000 a year despite having $250,000 of student loan debt. It's the parent who took out a PLUS loan for their kid to go to college and now they're settled. It's people who are defaulted and getting their Social Security benefits garnished. And so it really hits all walks of life. By canceling student loan debt, you close the racial wealth gap. By canceling student loan debt, you give women a chance to succeed in the workforce. By canceling student loan debt, you really do have a path to dignity for 43 million Americans and to be able to set a marker of like, we're going to be a country that invests in education as opposed to defunding education.
What are the key advocacy groups?
The Debt Collective, which also goes by Strike Debt on Twitter. So you do a lot of great work working with debtors and creating people to go on strike from paying their debt. And they've done a lot of great work over the years around the for-profit colleges and what's happening in people who went to the for-profit colleges. You have Student Debt Crisis there, and then you have AFT and NEA. They are doing amazing work on student debt. You have the Education Trust. NAACP has been doing work on student debt, and now every group is starting to work on it. It's really great. It's great seeing all of these organizations that are doing work. Justice Democrats is working on it. You have a whole wide range, and it's really beautiful to watch. It's like that scene in The Avengers when everybody just starts showing up on the issue, and it's wonderful. And I know that we have the ability to win.
Who's on the other side? Who's most formidable?
I don't know how formidable they are, but I mean, there's this economist or researcher, Sandy Baum, who always shows up to critique canceling student loan debt. Like there's people at Brookings, there's people at the Peterson Institute, there's some Republicans, and they all get very concerned trolly about it because they're all like, well, what about this person or what about that? Thankfully, I think the tide has really, really shifted. And so it's more at this point about holding together the Democrats as opposed to, you know, taking seriously the opposition. Obviously you always take serious the opposition and track them. But if we can hold our folks together because we can do it through executive action, then we can just, you know, eye roll a bit at the people who are fine with folks struggling, and just to really be able to show that we don't want folks to struggle. We can work collectively together so that way we all have access to having a really good life.
Well, it's really been an honor to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
This is good talking to you. This has been a lot of fun to really think about these issues and have conversation. It's great because you've done such great work over the years just, you know, with NGP and like having our, like we wouldn't be able to do win these elections, run these campaigns without having the technology so that way we don't have to recreate the wheel with every race. And that has enabled us to have a battlefield to even compete on. So it's been really fun talking with you and seeing the great work that you're doing.
Well, thanks, Melissa. That was Melissa Byrne. She is at MC Byrne on Twitter. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.